The odds were long against the Jews. Iran was a Muslim country. India was partly Muslim, and its delegate was a Muslim, as well as representing a British Commonwealth nation. Canada and Australia were also of the British Commonwealth. Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia in the Soviet bloc had a traditional history of anti-Zionism. The South American representatives, Uruguay, Peru, and Guatemala, were Catholic in predomination and could possibly be influenced by the Vatican's lukewarm feeling toward Zionism. Only Sweden and the Netherlands could be considered fully nonpartisan. Nonetheless, the Yishuv welcomed UNSCOP. The Arabs opposed the presence of the United Nations. Inside Palestine, a general strike of the Arabs was called, demonstrations were held, and the air was filled with oaths and threats. Outside of Palestine, the Arab countries began riots and blood pogroms against their Jews. Barak Ben Kanan, the old warrior and negotiator, was once again pressed into service by the Yishuv. He joined Ben Gurion and Dr. Weizmann on the advisory committee to UNSCOP. Chapter 13. Kitty and Karen returned to Gan Dafna. Kitty waited for the right moment to have it out with Karen. When the letter from Dov Landau arrived, she decided to delay it no longer. Kitty poured a lemon rinse over Karen's head and wrung out her long, thick brown hair and rubbed the girl's head briskly with a big towel. "Phew," Karen said, taking a corner of the towel to wipe the soap from her eyes. The water boiled in the tea kettle. Karen got up and tied the towel around her head and brewed a pot of tea. Kitty sat at the kitchen table, filing her fingernails. She began to paint them carefully with polish. "What's bothering you?" Karen said disarmingly. "Good Lord, I'm not even allowed the privacy of my own thoughts. Something is wrong. Something's been wrong since you came back from your trip to the Sea of Galilee. Did something happen between you and Ari?" "Plenty happened between me and Ari, but that's not what is disturbing me. Karen, we have to have a talk about us and our futures. I guess we'd better do it right now."
"I don't understand."
Kitty waved her hands to dry her fingernails. She stood up and lit a cigarette awkwardly.
"You know how much you mean to me, and how much I love you?"
"I think so,"
the girl whispered.
"Since that first day at Carolus, I've wanted you to be my girl."
"I've wanted it that way too, Kitty."
"Then you'll believe that I have thought this all out carefully, and what I want to do is for your own good. You must have faith in me."
"I do. You know that."
"What I'm about to say will be hard for you to appreciate fully. It is hard for me to come to this, too, for I am very fond of many children here, and I have grown quite attached to Gan Dafna. Karen, I want to take you home to America with me."
The girl stared at Kitty as though she had been slapped. For a moment, she did not even understand or believe she had heard it right.
"Home? But this is my home. I have no other home. I want your home to be with me, always. I want that too, Kitty. I want it more than anything. It is so strange."
"What is, dear?"
"When you said home, in America. But I am an American, Karen, and I miss my home."
Karen bit her lip to keep from crying.
"That's funny, isn't it? I thought we would go on like we were. You would be at Gan Dafna, and you would go off into the Palmach, and then to some kibbutz out on a border. I guess that's what I thought. There are many things I have learned to love here, but this is not my country, and these are not my people. I guess I have been selfish,"
Karen said.
I never thought of you as getting homesick or wanting anything for yourself. That is the nicest thing anyone has ever said to me.
Karen poured two cups of tea and tried to think. Kitty was everything to her.
But leave?
I don't know how to say it, Kitty, but ever since I was old enough to read in Denmark, I've asked myself the question about being Jewish. I still don't know the answer. I only know that I have something here that is mine. No one is going to take it from me. Whatever it is, it's the most important thing in the world. Someday I might know the words for it. But I can't leave Palestine. Whatever you have, you will still have it. Jews in America, and I suppose Jews everywhere, have this same belonging that you have. Going away won't change that. But they are exiles. No, baby. Don't you understand that Jews in America love their country? The Jews of Germany loved their country, too.
Stop it! Kitty cried suddenly. We are not that kind of people, and I will not listen to those lies they fill you with.
She caught herself quickly.
There are Jews in America who love their country so much they would prefer death to ever living to see what happened to Germany come to America.
She walked up behind the girl's chair and touched her shoulder.
Don't you think I know how difficult this is for you? Do you believe I would do anything to hurt you?
No,
Karen whispered. Kitty faced Karen and knelt before her chair.
Oh, Karen, you don't even know the meaning of peace. In all your life, you have never been able to walk in the light of the sun without fear. Do you think it will be any better here? Do you think it will ever be better? Karen, I want you to go on being a Jew, and I want you to go on loving your land. But there are other things I want for you, too.
Karen turned her eyes away from Kitty.
If you stay here, you'll spend your whole life with a gun in your hands. You'll turn hard and cynical, like Ari and Jordana. I guess it isn't fair of me to have expected you would stay. Come with me, Karen. Give us both a chance. We need each other. We've both had enough suffering. I don't know if I can leave. I don't know. I just don't,
she said with a shaky voice.
Oh, Karen, I want so much to see you in saddle shoes and pleated skirts going out to a football game in a cut-down Ford. I want to hear the phone ringing and you giggling and talking to your boyfriend. I want you full of delicious nonsense as a teenage girl should be, not carrying a gun in your hands or smuggling ammunition. There are so many things that you are missing. You must at least find out they are in the world before you make your final decision. Please, Karen, please.
Karen was pale. She walked away from Kitty.
What about Dove?
Kitty took Dove's letter from her pocket and handed it to Karen.
I found this on my desk. I don't know how it got there. Mrs. Fremont, this letter is being written by someone who knows more better how to say in English than I do, but I copy it to show it is my writing. This letter must be sent to you in a special way for reasons you know of. I am very busy these days. I am with friends. My friends are the first I have in a long time, and they are real good friends. Now that I am permanent situated, I want to write to you and to say how glad I am not to be at Gandafna no more, where everybody makes me sick, including you and Karen Clement. I write to say I won't see Karen Clement no more, as I am too busy and with real friends. I don't want Karen Clement to think I am going to come back and take care of her. She is nothing but a kid. I have a real woman of my own age, and we live together and everything. Why don't you go with Karen Clement to America? Because she doesn't belong here. Dov Landau.
Kitty took the letter from Karen's hand and ripped it to shreds.
I will tell Dr. Lieberman that I am resigning. As soon as we can straighten up matters here, we will book passage to America. All right, Kitty. I'll go with you,
Karen said. Chapter 14. Every few weeks, the Maccabee High Command changed its headquarters. After Hell's Fortnight and the assassination of Arnold Havenhurst, Ben Moshe and Akiva thought it would be best to get out of Jerusalem for a while. The Maccabees were a small organization, a few hundred full-time members and a few thousand part-time, with a few thousand more sympathizers. Because they had to remain constantly on the move, the headquarters command group carried no more than a half dozen of the top men. Now the pressure was so great that the command split up and only four persons went to Tel Aviv. There was Akiva and Ben Moshe and Nahum Ben Ami, the brother of David, and there was little Giora, Dov Landau. Dov had become a personal favorite of Akiva. He had gained the inner circle of the Maccabee command by his fame in the raids and by the usefulness of his talents in forgery. The four moved into a basement apartment owned by a fellow Maccabee, located on B'nai Barak Road, near the central bus station and the old market, where there was great activity. Maccabee lookouts were posted around the apartment house, and an escape route was worked out. It looked ideal, and could have been worse. For nearly 15 years, Akiva had frustrated CID and British intelligence. There was a period of amnesty during World War II when Akiva was free, but for the rest of that time, he was wanted. He had always evaded them and had escaped many traps that had been set for him. Akiva was the biggest prize in Palestine, with the price on his head running to several thousand pounds sterling. It was coincidence that the CID was observing the activities of another apartment house on B'nai Barak Road, just three houses away from the new Maccabee headquarters. The suspects were a ring of smugglers who had been storing goods got past customs in the Yaffa port. The alert CID men, watching from an observation point in a building across the street, spotted the suspicious picket of watchmen regularly near the basement headquarters. With a telescopic lens camera, they photographed all the lookouts and identified two as known Maccabees. While stalking smugglers, they had stumbled onto a Maccabee hangout. Their long experience with the Maccabees induced them to raid at once. They organized quickly and moved to effect complete surprise. They still had no idea they were going into Maccabee headquarters itself. Dov was in one of the three rooms of the basement apartment forging an El Salvador passport. Only Akiva was with him. Nahum and Ben Moshe had gone out to meet Zev Gilboa, the liaison for the Haganah and Palmach. Akiva came into the room.
"Well, well, little Giora," Akiva said. "How did you manage to talk Ben Moshe out of taking you along on today's business?"
"I must finish this passport," Dov grumbled. Akiva looked at his watch and then stretched out on a cot behind Dov.
"They should be returning shortly."
"I don't trust the Haganah," Dov said.
"We have no choice but to trust them for the time being," the old man said.
Dov held the passport paper up to the light to study his erasures and see if they could be detected through the watermarks and seal. It was a good job. Not even an expert could spot where he had worked over the name and description of the former owner. Dov bent close to the paper and etched in the signature of an El Salvador official, then put the pen down. He got up and paced the tiny room restlessly, checking frequently to see if the ink was dry, then resuming his walking, back and forth, snapping his fingers.
"Don't be so impatient, little Giora," You will find that waiting is the worst part of underground life. Waiting for what? I often wonder.
I've lived underground before, Dov said quickly.
So you have. Akiva sat up and stretched. Waiting, 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 Akiva said. You are very young, Dov. You should learn not to be quite so serious and quite so intense. That was always one of my faults. I was always too intense. Worked day and night for the cause.
That sounds strange coming from Akiva, Dov said.
An old man begins to see many things. We wait for a chance to wait. If they get us, the best we can expect is exile or life in prison. The hanging and the torture is getting to be standard procedure these days. That's why I say, don't be so serious. There are many nice Maccabee girls who would love to meet our little Giora. Have fun while there is time.
I am not interested, Dov said firmly.
Aha, the old man teased. Perhaps you already have a girl. You have been holding out on us.
I had a girl once, Dov said, but no more.
I must tell Ben Moshe to find you a new one, and you will go out and enjoy yourself.
I don't want one, and I'll stay in headquarters. It is the most important place to be.
The old man lay back again, and he meditated. At length he spoke.
How wrong you are, little Giora. How very wrong you are. The most important place to be is awakening in the morning and looking out at your fields, working in them, and coming home at night to someone you love and who loves you.
The old man is getting sentimental again, Dov thought. He tried the paper and found it dry. He fitted the passport photo into place. As Akiva dozed on the cot, Dov began his pacing again. It was worse now that he had sent the letter to Mrs. Fremont. He wanted to go on raids, another raid and another and another. Sooner or later the British would get him and hang him, and it would be all over with. They didn't know that his bravery came from the fact that he didn't care. He almost begged to be hit by enemy gunfire. The dream was bad these days, and Karen was not there to stand between him and the gas chamber door. Mrs. Fremont would take her to America now. That would be good. And he would keep on going on raids until they got him. Because it was no good to live without Karen. Outside of the apartment, 50 plain-clothed British police intermingled with the crowds near the bus station. They moved quickly, picking up the Maccabee lookouts and whisking them out of the area before they could give a warning. Then they cordoned off the entire block. 15 police armed with shotguns, tear gas, axes, and sledgehammers slipped down to the basement apartment and stationed themselves around the door. There was a knock. Akiva's eyes fluttered open.
That must be Ben Moshe and Nahum. Let them in, Dov.
Dov slipped the chain latch into place and opened the door a crack. A sledgehammer crashed into the door, ripping it open.
British!
Dov screamed. Akiva and little Giora captured. The word was on every lip in Palestine. The legendary Akiva, who had eluded the British for more than a decade, was now theirs.
Betrayal! Cried the Maccabees.
They placed the blame on the Haganah. Ben Moshe and Nahum Ben Ami had been meeting with Zeb Gilboa. Either Gilboa or some other Haganah person had followed them to learn the Maccabee headquarters. How else could it have been found? The two factions were again at odds. The Maccabees voiced accusations. 100 rumors circulated purporting to reveal how the Haganah had managed its alleged sellout. The British High Commissioner for Palestine moved for an immediate trial to produce a quick sentence which would further demoralize the Maccabees. He felt that swift justice for Akiva would restore British authority and curtail the Maccabee activities, since the old man had long been the spiritual force behind the terrorists. the High Commissioner arranged a secret trial. The name of the judge was withheld for his own safety. Akiva and Little Giora were sentenced to be hanged within a fortnight of their capture. They were both incarcerated in the impenetrable Akko jail. In his eagerness, the High Commissioner had made a disastrous mistake. Newsmen had been barred from the trial, and in the United States in particular, the Maccabees had powerful friends and financial aid. The guilt or innocence of Akiva and Little Giora were lost sight of in the passionate outbursts that followed. Like the Exodus incident, the sentencing of the pair was being turned into a focus for violent protest of the British mandate. Dov's background of the Warsaw Ghetto and Auschwitz was dug up and published, producing a wave of public sympathy all over Europe. There was indignation over the secrecy of the trial. Pictures of the 80-year-old Akiva and 18-year-old Little Giora, the prophet and the disciple, captured the imagination of readers. Newsmen demanded to see the pair. Cecil Bradshaw was in Palestine with UNSCOP. Having seen what could happen in the case of the Exodus, he quickly went into a conference with the High Commissioner and applied to the Home Office for instructions. The incident was creating ill will for the British at a delicate time when the United Nations Committee was in Palestine. Instead of halting Maccabee activity, the affair might trigger a new rash of terror. Bradshaw and the High Commissioner decided to move quickly to show the world that British justice was merciful. Using the extreme ages of Dov and Akiva as an excuse, they announced that they would allow the sentenced pair to make petitions for mercy and spare their lives. Their action put a halt to the storm of protest. The High Commissioner and Bradshaw themselves went to the Akko prison to see Akiva and Dov and tell them the good news. The latter were brought into the warden's office, where the two officials bluntly explained the proposal. "We are reasonable people," the commissioner said. "We have arranged these petitions for you to sign. Officially, they are petitions for mercy. However, off the record, it is merely a formality, a loophole, if you will."
"Now you sign these petitions," Bradshaw said, "and we will give you a fair compromise. We'll take you two out of the country. You'll serve a short term in one of the colonies in Africa, and in a few years, it will have all blown over."
"I don't quite understand you," Akiva said. "What are we serving a sentence in Africa for? We have committed no crime. We are merely fighting for our natural and historical rights. Since when has it been a crime for a soldier to fight for his country? We are prisoners of war. You have no right to pass any sentence on us. We are an occupied country."
The High Commissioner broke into a sweat. The old man was going to be stubborn. He had heard Maccabee fanatics recite that theme before.
"See here, Akiva, this is beyond arguing politics. It is your life. Either you sign these petitions for mercy, or we will carry through the sentences."
Akiva looked at the two men, whose anxiety was fully apparent. He was quite aware that the British were trying to gain an advantage or undo a mistake.
"You there, boy," Bradshaw said to Dove. "You don't want to hang on the gallows, do you? You sign, and Akiva will sign afterwards."
Bradshaw shoved the petition across the desk and took out his pen. Dove looked at the document a moment. He spit on it. Akiva looked at the two frustrated, half-frightened Englishmen.
"Thine own mouth condemneth thee," he snapped.
The rebuff by Akiva and Little Giora of the mercy petitions was carried in headlines as a dramatic protest against the British. Tens of thousands in the Yishuv, who had formerly had little regard for the Maccabees, were inspired by the action. Overnight, the old man and the boy became the symbol of Jewish resistance. Instead of damaging the Maccabees, the British were well on their way toward creating a pair of martyrs. They had no choice now but to set the hanging date 10 days away. Every day the tension grew in Palestine. The raids of the Maccabees and the Haganah had stopped, but the country knew it was sitting on a short, fused powder keg. The all-Arab city of Acre stood at the northern end of an arched bay with Haifa on the southern end. Acre Jail was a monstrosity built on Crusader ruins. It ran along a seawall that stretched from the prison at the northern outskirt of the town to the opposite end of the city. Ahmad el-Jazar, the butcher, had turned it into an Ottoman fortress, and it had stood against Napoleon. It was a conglomeration of parapets, dungeons, tunnels, towers, dried-up moats, courtyards, and thick walls. The British converted it into one of the most dreaded prisons in the empire's penal system. Dov and Akiva were placed in tiny cells in the north wing. The walls, ceiling, and floors were made of stone. The cell's dimensions were 6 feet by 8 feet. The outside wall was 16 feet thick. There was no light and no toilet. A stink of mustiness was present continuously. Each door was a solid sheet of iron with a tiny peephole for viewing, covered from the outside. The only other opening in the cells was a slit 2 inches wide and 12 inches high cut through from the outside wall that allowed in a thin ray of light. Through it, Dov could see the tops of some trees and the rim of Napoleon's Hill, which marked the farthest advance point in the drive to conquer India. Akiva fared badly. The ceilings and walls dripped, and the clammy damp penetrated his ancient, inflamed joints and put him in agonizing pain. 2 or 3 times each day, British officials came to plead for some sort of compromise to prevent the hanging. Dov merely ignored them. Akiva sent them out with quotations from the Bible ringing in their ears. 6 days remained before the hanging. Akiva and Dov were moved to the death cells adjoining the hanging room. These were conventional barred cells in another wing of the prison. 4 concrete walls, a deep hole under the floor, and a trapdoor under a steel-beamed rigging to hold the rope. A sandbag of the weight of a man was used in testing. The guards pulled the lever to release the trapdoor and let the sandbag fall with a crunching thud. Dov and Akiva were dressed in scarlet pants and shirts, the traditional English hanging dress. Chapter 15. It was 1 o'clock in the morning. Bruce Sutherland dozed in his library with his head bowed over a book. He sat up quickly, awakened by a sharp knocking. His servant ushered Karen Clement into the room. Sutherland rubbed his eyes.
"What the devil are you doing here this time of night?"
Karen stood before him, trembling.
"Does Kitty know you are here?"
Karen shook her head. Sutherland led her to a chair. Karen was white and tense.
"Have you eaten, Karen?"
"I'm not hungry,"
she said.
"Bring her a sandwich and some milk," Sutherland ordered his servant. "Now see here, young lady, what is all this about?"
"I want to see Dov Landau. You are the only one I know who can help me."
Sutherland snorted and paced the room with his hands clasped behind him.
"Even if I can help you, this can only hurt you more. You and Kitty will be leaving Palestine in a few weeks. Why don't you try to forget him, child?"
"Please," she pleaded. "I know all the reasons why. I have thought of nothing else since he was captured. I must see him once more. Please help me, General Sutherland. Please."
"I'll do what I can," he said. "First, let me call Kitty and tell her you are here. She is probably half out of her mind. You had no business traveling through Arab country as you did."
The next morning, Sutherland called Jerusalem. The High Commissioner was quick in granting the request. The British were still trying to get Dov and Akiva to change their minds and were willing to grab at any straws. There was a possibility that Karen's visit could break the armor of Dov's defiance. It was arranged quickly. Kitty left Gandafna and was picked up in Swat by Sutherland, whence the three drove to Naharia on the coast. There, from the police station, an escort took them directly into Akka jail, where they were taken to the warden's office. Karen had been in a daze all the way to Akka. Now in the prison, it seemed even more unreal to her. The warden came in.
All right, young lady.
I'd better go with you, Kitty said. I want to see him alone,
Karen said firmly. A pair of armed guards waited for Karen outside the warden's office. They led her through a series of iron doors and into a huge stone courtyard surrounded by barred windows. Karen could see the eyes of the prisoners leering at her. Some catcalls echoed in the hollow yard. She looked straight ahead. They walked up narrow steps into the death wing. They passed through a barbed wire machine gun emplacement, then came to another door where two soldiers stood with fixed bayonets on their rifles. She was ushered into a tiny cell. The door was closed behind her, and a soldier stood near. He opened a slot in the wall, measuring a few inches wide and a few inches high. You'll talk to him through that slot there, girlie, the guard said. Karen nodded and looked into it. She could see the two cells on the other side of the wall. She saw Akiva in the first and Dove in the other, his scarlet dress. Dove lay on his back, staring at the ceiling. Karen could see a guard enter and unlock his cell door.
Up, Landau, the guard barked. Somebody to see you.
Dove picked up a book from the floor and opened it and read.
You've got a visitor.
Dove turned a page in the book.
I said, you've got a visitor.
I'm not in for any of your goodwill ambassadors. Tell them I said to go.
It ain't one of ours. It's one of yours. It's a girl, Landau.
Dove's hands tightened on the book and his heart raced.
Tell her I'm busy.
The guard shrugged and walked to the slot in the wall.
He says he don't want to see nobody.
Dove!
Karen called.
Dove!
Her voice echoed in the death cell.
Dove, it's me, Karen.
Akiva looked tensely to Dove's cell. Dove gritted his teeth and turned another page.
Dove! Dove! Dove!
Talk to her, boy! Akiva shouted. Don't go to your grave in the silence my brother has condemned me to. Talk to her, boy!
Dove set the book down and rolled off the cot. He motioned the guard to open his cell door. He walked to the slot and looked into it. He could see only her face. Karen looked into his cold, blue, angry eyes.
I don't want no more tricks, he said acidly. If they sent you here to beg, just turn around and get out. I'm not asking for mercy from these bastards.
Don't talk like that to me, Dove.
I know they sent you.
I swear. No one asked me to come. I swear it.
Then what are you doing here?
I just wanted to see you once again.
Dove clenched his teeth and kept his control. Why did she have to come? He nearly died with wanting to touch her cheek.
How do you feel?
Fine. Just fine.
There was a long silence.
Dove, did you really mean what you wrote to Kitty? Or did you just say it because...
I meant it.
I wanted to know.
Well, you know now.
Yes, I know. Dove, I'll be leaving Eretz Yisrael soon. I'm going to America.
Dove shrugged.
I guess I shouldn't have come. I'm sorry I bothered you.
That's all right. I know you was just trying to be nice. I would really like to see my girl, but she's a Maccabee and she can't come. She's my own age, you know.
I know.
Anyhow, you're a nice kid, Karen, and... Get to America and forget all about this business here. And good luck.
I guess I had better go,
Karen whispered. She stood up. Dove's expression did not change.
Karen!
She turned quickly.
just to show that we are friends, we could shake hands if the guard says it's all right.
Karen put her hand through the opening, and Dov pressed it between his own and pressed his forehead against the wall and closed his eyes. Karen grasped his hand and pulled it back to her side of the wall.
No, he said. No.
But he could not resist. She kissed his hand and pressed it against her cheek and her lips, and he felt the tears from her eyes. And then she was gone. His cell door clanged behind him. Dov flopped on his bed. In all of his lifetime, he could not remember shedding tears. But now nothing could stop them. He turned his back to the door so the guards and Akiva could not see his face. And he wept softly from his heart. Barak ben Kanan was one of the Yeshuv advisors who traveled with the UNSCOP as it inspected Palestine and made its various inquiries. The Yeshuv showed its proud record of land reclamations, rehabilitation for the homeless, the progress of the kibbutzim and factories and the cities they had built. The UNSCOP delegates were impressed by the contrast of the Jewish and Arab communities. After the inspection tours, formal inquiries were opened in which each side was allowed to present its case. Ben-Gurion, Weizmann, Barak Ben-Kanan, and the other Yeshuv leaders argued with tremendous skill the morality and justice of the Jewish case. On the Arab side, the Higher Arab Committee, steered by the Husseini family, stirred up bitter demonstrations against the United Nations. They barred the committee from many of the Arab towns where the squalor and primitive factory conditions would turn the strongest stomach. When the inquiries opened, the Arabs officially boycotted it. It became obvious to the UNSCOP that there could be no middle road in Palestine. On a basis of strict justice, the United Nations would have to recommend a settlement in favor of the Jews. But there was the weight of Arab threats to consider. The Jews had long accepted the theory of compromise and partition, yet they were fearful of the creation of a land ghetto like the Pale. With the tour of Palestine and the inquiries concluded, the UNSCOP prepared to leave and retire to Geneva to analyze their findings while a subcommittee studied the displaced persons camps in Europe, which still held a quarter of a million desperate Jews. They would then present recommendations to the General Assembly of the United Nations. Barak ben Kanan once again accepted a commission to travel to Geneva and continue his advisory capacity. He returned to Yad El a few days before departure for Geneva so that he might spend some time with Sarah, who, despite his many departures, had never quite got used to them. Neither did she ever get used to Jordana's and Ari's being away. Ari and David Ben-Ami were at the nearby Ein Or kibbutz at Palmach headquarters for the Hula. They came to Yad El, and Jordana came down from Gandafna for a farewell dinner. Barak was preoccupied through the entire evening. He spoke little of the UNSCOP, the coming trip, or of the pressing politics. It was a grim reunion.
I suppose you've heard that Mrs. Fremont is leaving Palestine,
Jordana said at the end of dinner.
No, I didn't hear, Ari said, masking his surprise.
She is. She has given her notice to Dr. Lieberman. She is taking the Clement girl with her. I knew she would run at the first sign of real trouble.
Why shouldn't she go? Ari said. She is an American, and the girl is what she came to Palestine for.
She never had any use for us, Jordana snapped. That's not true, David said in defense. Don't always take her side, David. She's a nice woman, Sarah Ben-Kanan said, and I like her. Many times she passed this way and visited with me. She was very good to those children, and they love her. She's better gone, Jordana persisted. It is a shame she is taking the girl with her, but she has the child so spoiled now one would not think she was a Jewish girl.
Ari stood up and walked from the cottage.
"Why must you make it a point to hurt Ari?" Sarah said angrily. "You know what he feels for her, and she is a fine person." "He's well rid of her," Jordana said.
"And who are you to judge a man's heart?" Barak said.
David took Jordana's hand.
"You promised we would take a horseback ride. You are on her side too, David. I like Kitty Fremont. Come, let's go for that ride."
Jordana strode from the room, and David followed.
"Let them go, Sarah," Barak said. "David will calm her down. I'm afraid our daughter is jealous of Mrs. Fremont, as well she might be. Someday, our girls may have the time to concentrate on being women."
Barak played with his tea, and his wife stood behind his chair and laid her cheek on his thick red hair.
"Barak, you cannot go on like this. You must speak, or you shall regret it to your grave."
He patted his wife's hand.
"I will find Ari," he said.
Ari was near the orchard looking up into the hills at Gandafna when Barak came upon him.
"Does she matter that much, son?"
Ari shrugged.
"I rather liked her myself," Barak said. "What is the difference? She comes from a world filled with silk stockings and perfume, and she's going back to it."
Barak held his son's arm, and they walked through their fields to the place where the Jordan River ran past their farm. They could see Jordana and David riding away, and they could hear her laughter.
"You see, Jordana is over it already. How are things with the Palmach at Ein Ohr?"
"As they have always been, father. Good boys and girls, but too few of them and too little to fight with. We cannot expect to win a war against seven armies."
The sprinklers began whirling in the fields as the sun started its plunge behind the Lebanese hills near Fort Esther. The father and the son watched their fields for a long time. Each of them wondered if there would ever come a day when the only thing to worry about was the mending of a fence or the plowing of their land.
"Let's go back to the house," Ari said. "Emma is alone."
Ari turned to go. He felt his father's giant hand on his shoulder. He turned. His father's great head was bowed in sadness.
"I leave for Geneva in 2 days. I leave with sorrow as I have never known. For 15 years, someone has been missing from our table. I have been a proud and stubborn man. But I have paid the price of pride with torment. It is hell for me now. Ari, my son, do not let my brother Akiva hang at the end of a British rope."
Chapter 16. Jerusalem seethed on the eve of the UNSCOP departure. In the Arab sector, inflammatory oratory rang out to the wild chantings of Arab mobs. The city was split into fortified areas, cordoned off with barbed wire, and guarded by Tommies entrenched behind massed guns. Ari Ben Canaan moved through Jerusalem, crossing from sector to sector to all of the known hangouts of Bar Israel, the Maccabee contact man. Bar Israel seemed to have disappeared. There had been no liaison between Maccabees and Haganah since the capture of Akiva and Little Giora. Ari was not without his sources of information, however, and he found out that Bar Israel was living in a room in the El Katamon district. Ari went directly to the room and unceremoniously shoved the door open. Bar Israel was engaged in a chess game. He looked up, saw Ari, and returned to studying the chessboard.
"Get out," Ari ordered the other player.
He shoved the man through the door and closed it.
"You knew damned well I was looking for you."
Bar Israel shrugged and lit a cigar.
You left 50 love letters all over Jerusalem.
Then why didn't you contact me? I've been in Jerusalem for 24 hours. You've made your dramatic entrance. Now what do you want?
Take me to Ben Moshe.
We aren't playing with you boys anymore. We have an aversion to Haganah commanders learning our headquarters.
You're not talking to a Haganah commander. You are talking to Ari Ben Canaan, the nephew of Akiva.
Ari, I trust you personally, but orders are orders.
Ari snatched Bar Israel out of his chair, spilling the chessboard to the floor. He held the little Oriental by the lapels and shook him as though he were a weightless sack.
You are going to take me to Ben Moshe, or I am going to snap your neck.
Ben Moshe sat at his desk at Maccabee headquarters in the Greek colony. Beside him stood Nahum Ben-Ami. The two men glared angrily at the bewildered Bar Israel and Ari Ben Canaan.
We all know Ari, Bar Israel whimpered. I took a chance.
Get out, Ben Moshe snarled at the sweating man. We will settle with you later.
Now that you are here, Ben Canaan, what do you want?
I want to know what you plan to do about Akiva and the boy.
Do? Why, nothing, of course. What can we do?
You are a liar, Ari said.
Whatever we do, it is none of your damned business, Nahum said.
Ari smashed his fist on the desk so hard, it splintered the top.
It is my business. Akiva is my uncle.
Ben Moshe remained icy. We have had enough cooperation with traitors. Ari leaned forward until his face was inches from Moshe's.
I hate your guts, Ben Moshe, and I hate yours, Nahum Ben-Ami. But I am not leaving until I know your plans.
You are asking for a bullet through your brain.
You shut up, Nahum, or I'll dismantle you, Ari said.
Ben Moshe took off his glasses, wiped them, and put them back on.
Ari, you have such a pleasant way of persuasion, he said.
We are going into the Acho jail and take Akiva and little Giora out. That is what I thought. When?
The day after tomorrow.
I am going with you.
Nahum started to protest, but Ben Moshe held up his hand to be quiet.
You give your word the Haganah does not know about you being here?
You have it.
What is his word? Nahum said.
I take the word of a Ben Canaan.
I still do not like it, Nahum said.
That is too bad, then. You know what this means, of course, Ari. We have mobilized our greatest strength. You have been in the Acho jail. You know what it is like. If we can do this thing, it will break the British backs. Acho is an all-Arab city. The jail is the toughest stronghold they have in Palestine. Let me see your plans.
Ben Moshe opened the desk and took out a sheaf of blueprints. Everything in the Acho area had been covered. There was a layout of the town, the exterior approaches to the prison, the escape roads. The diagrams of the prison's interior were perfect as far as Ari could judge. They must have been drawn up by people who had been prisoners. The guard stations, the arsenal, the main communications center were all pinpointed on the maps. Ari studied the timetables of the attack. They were masterpieces. Heavy explosives, grenades, and landmines, all manufactured by the Maccabees, were ingeniously employed.
What do you think, Ari?
Everything is perfect, up to a point. I see how you are going to get in and get them outside. But the escape from Acho...
Ari shook his head.
This will never work.
We cannot hide conveniently at the nearest kibbutz,
Nahum Ben-Ami snapped.
We know the chance of complete escape is very slim,
Ben Moshe agreed.
It is not very slim. It is nil. Of course, I know you Maccabees pride yourselves on being dead heroes. Unless you set up better getaway plans, that is what you're going to become.
I know what he is going to suggest, Nahum said.
He will suggest we cooperate with the Haganah and the Kibbutzim.
That is exactly what I'm going to suggest. If you don't, you'll have a lot of new martyrs. Ben Moshe, you are brave, but you are not crazy. As the matter stands now, you have possibly a 2% chance. If you allow me to set up more complete escape plans, your chances will become 50-50.
Watch him, Nahum said. He talks too slickly.
Go on, Ari.
Ari spread the master map out on the desk. I suggest that you take an extra 10 or 15 minutes inside the prison and use that time to free every prisoner in the place. They will scatter in 20 directions and force the British to chase them all, and thereby cut the British strength.
Ben Moshe nodded.
Now, our own groups should also break up into small units, and each unit head out a different way from Aho. I will take Akiva with me, and you will take the boy.
Go on,
Nahum Ben-Ami said. As he listened, he realized Ari was making sense. For my route, I will break for Kfar Masaryk. There I will change transportation to throw them off, and use back roads to go up to Mount Carmel, south of Haifa. I have trusted friends in the Druze village of Daliat El Carmil. The British won't even begin to look up there.
It sounds good, Nahum said. The Druzes can be trusted, better than some Jews I know.
Ari ignored the insult. The second unit, carrying Dov Landau, will go up the coast road to Nacharia and split. I can arrange sanctuary in a half dozen kibbutzim in the area. I suggest that Landau be taken to Mishmar Kibbutz on the Lebanese border. I was there at the building of Mishmar. The area is filled with caves. Your brother David was with me at Mishmar in the Second World War. We have used it for years as a hiding place for our leaders. Landau will be absolutely safe there. Ben Moshe sat like a statue, looking over his plans. Without these hiding places, he knew he had no more than a dramatic suicide mission. With Ari's help, there was a chance. Could he risk cooperation?
Go on, Ari. Set up your escape routes.
I do this only because your name is Ben Canaan.
D-Day minus 4. 4 days separated Akiva and little Giora from a rope. The Unskop flew out of Lydda to Geneva. Palestine felt the deathly tense foreboding calm. The Arab demonstrations stopped. Maccabee raids stopped. The city was an armed camp with British plainclothes men flooding the area.
D-Day minus 3. A last-ditch appeal from the Prime Minister of Great Britain was turned down by Akiva and little Giora.
D-Day.
Market day in Aho.
At daybreak, Arab crowds converged on the city from 20 Galilee villages. The market areas were packed with donkeys and carts and produce. The roads were filled with travelers. Oriental and African Jews, members of the Maccabees dressed as Arabs, drifted into Aho with the influx of the market day throngs. Each man and woman carried a few sticks of dynamite, caps, wires, detonators, grenades, or small arms under their long dress. The Maccabees dispersed and mingled in the market stalls near the prison and throughout the jammed bazaar.
11 o'clock, H hour minus 2. 250 Maccabee men and 50 Maccabee women in Arab dress were now dispersed in Aho.
11:15,
H hour minus 1:45. The guard changed inside the Aho jail. 4 inside Maccabee collaborators stood by.
11:30,
H hour minus 1:30. Outside Aho at Napoleon's Hill, a second unit of Maccabees assembled. 3 truckloads of men dressed as British soldiers drove into Aho and parked along the seawall near the prison. The soldiers quickly broke up into 4-man units and walked through the streets as though on security patrol.
There were so many other soldiers about that this 100 new people received no attention. High noon. H hour minus one. Ari Ben Kanan drove into Akko in a staff car dressed as a British major. His driver parked on the seawall on the west side of the prison. Ari walked out on the big rampart at the north end of the seawall and leaned against a rusted old Turkish cannon. He lit a cigarette and watched the waves lap against the seawall below him. The foam swirled around the mossy green rocks worn flat by the waters. 12:05, H hour minus 55 minutes. The shops of Akko closed one by one for the two-hour midday break. The sun was getting hot, and it blazed down on the Arabs in the coffee houses, who began to doze as the mournful wails of Radio Cairo blared. The British troops were stifled and groggy in the heat. 12:10, H hour minus 50 minutes. A Muslim caller climbed the long spiral stairs of the minaret beside the mosque of El Jazar. The caller cried out in the stillness, and the Mohammedans gathered in the courtyard and inside the huge white-domed house of prayer and knelt in the direction of the holy city of Mecca. 12:12, H hour minus 48 minutes. The Maccabees moved toward their assembly points as the heat beat both Arabs and British soldiers into lethargy. In groups of twos and threes, they moved, without apparent purpose, through the narrow, dung-filled alleys to the assembly points. Group one gathered at the Abu Christos, Father of Christ, café. The café sat on the bay, and the coffee drinkers watched the Arab boys dive from the rocks for a grush. They could see the entire sweep of the bay and Haifa at the far end. A second large group came together at the mosque. They knelt at the outer fringes of the huge courtyard and joined the Arabs in prayer. The third unit went to the Khan, a large square that had been used for more than 100 years as a caravan resting and trading place. They mingled with the camels and the donkeys and the hundreds of market-day Arabs who lay on the ground and rested. Group four met on the docks by the fishing fleet. The fifth group assembled at the land gate on the seawall. At the same time, the 100 Maccabees, disguised as British soldiers, moved for their positions. They had a greater freedom of movement. They went to housetops and blocked alleyways and roads, so that they commanded every possible entrance and exit to Akko jail. Outside of Akko, the final unit of Maccabees got into position. These were people with no disguise. They planted landmines and stationed themselves on the highways with machine guns to stop British reinforcements from getting in to Akko. 12:45, H hour minus 15 minutes. The soldiers blocking off the jail were in position. The units on the highway outside Akko were in position. The striking force, the 250 disguised as Arabs, moved out of their assembly points in small groups and converged on the attack point. Ben Moshe and Ben Ami reached the spot first. They watched their people converging. They looked over the rooftops and saw their soldiers in place. They looked at the prison where one of the four inside helpers signaled that all was ready. Ari Ben Kanan walked to the edge of the rampart and flicked his cigarette out and walked quickly toward the attack point. The driver drifted along behind him in the car. The attack point was the Hamam el-Basha, a 120-year-old Turkish public bathhouse. The bathhouse, built by el-Jazar, was attached to the south wall of the Akko jail. In the rear of the bathhouse, there was a courtyard used for sunning. A single stairway led up to the roof of the bathhouse and right to the prison wall. The Maccabees had discovered that from their various guard posts inside the prison, the British could see every possible approach and detect every possible movement around the jail, except one place, the bathhouse and the south wall, and here was where they would strike. 1 o'clock, H hour. The city of Akko was burned into somnolence by the sun. Ben Moshe, Ben Kanan, and Ben Ami drew deep breaths and gave the signal. The raid of the Akko jail was on. Ari Ben Kanan led the spearhead of 50 men. They went into the bathhouse and through it quickly to the courtyard in the rear. His group carried sticks of dynamite. The Arabs sitting in the steaming rooms looked on in utter amazement. Terror seized them, and in a second the bathhouse was a confusion of wet, scrambling Arabs. A second force moved in and jammed the bathers into one steam-flooded room so they could not escape and give an alarm. Outside, Ben Moshe received the signal that Ari had reached the courtyard, and all the Arabs were trapped. In the courtyard at the rear of the bathhouse, Ari's men raced up the steps, crossed the roof to set their dynamite charge against the south wall of the prison. The explosives and caps and wires came out from under their clothing, and the charge was fixed with speed and efficiency. They retreated to the cover of the courtyard and lay flat. 1:15. An ear-shattering explosion shook Akko. The air was filled with flying rocks. It took a full 2 minutes for the dust to settle and reveal a huge breach in the jail wall. With the explosion, the four inside men carried out their assignments. The first threw a grenade on the switchboard, stopping all phone operation. The second grenaded the main switchbox, cutting the electricity and with it the alarm system. The third man seized the turnkey, and the fourth man rushed to the breach to direct the incoming Maccabees. Ari's men poured into the prison. The first objective of half his force was to get the arsenal. In a few moments, they were all equipped with heavy arms. The second section of Ari's force cut off the main guard barracks so that these troops could not get out as reinforcements. At intervals of 1 minute, Ben Moshe outside fed 10 and 20-man units into the prison. Each group knew exactly where to hit. Guards were gunned from their positions, and the Maccabees tore through the ancient passageways with Sten guns blazing and grenades blasting away obstacles. They fanned out, snatched their objectives, and with the precision of meticulous planning, they held the interior of the